Game on 2FM. With Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real.
Yes, a big thank you to Laura Fox for another entertaining afternoon. It is Tuesday, the 8th of February. I'm Shane Dawson. This is Game On, and this is what's coming up tonight. Can Ireland successfully bid for the Euros? And is it even a good idea?
This isn't a vanity decision. This isn't a decision which says, listen, we want to host Euro 2028 finals in Dublin because it looks good.
Well, I'm Ruby Walsh to go with Shane Dawson, but we're going to ask Mark Langdon if Man United can challenge for the title next year. Ralph Ragnick did suggest that. That is not one of my theories. And as soon as we're on that theme, I suppose, we might ask Mark some more ridiculous questions.
Rashford playing it in!
And myself and Ruby will be chatting to Gary Murphy as we look back on another great weekend for Irish golf and the small meteoric rise of Leona Maguire.
It's a first for Ireland and a first of many for Leona Maguire, an LPGA champion for the first time.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Ruby Walsh, it is great to have your company on this Tuesday evening. And before
Likewise, we do
get into the meaty, chunky FAI chat, and we'll have David Snide and Gavin Cooney on in a while. Ruby, I'm sure your attention last weekend was drawn to the successful Dublin Horse Racing Festival. And unfortunately, I was stuck in work watching it from the television screens. I didn't have the pleasure of being there. But there was also the small matter of an Irish victory over Wales in the rugby. And as much as people may associate yourself with horse racing, and rightly so, I only found out today that I could introduce you as Ruby Walsh, former rugby player.
Former amateur rugby player, Shane, I think is a more accurate description of that. But yeah, look, it was a hobby of mine. I played it till I was 18 and I loved it, and I still would consider myself a huge rugby fan. So whilst I had to watch a replay of the Irish Welsh game, I did watch England and Scotland in Murrayfield after the race and had finished in Leopardstown, and pleaded with, well, actually the penalty was turned over anyway, but the big debate was would Scotland kick it and go six up, or would they go to the corner? I was thinking, get the 6 points in front and just hang on to beat England, please. Then obviously you had France, Italy, but it's amazing. Every sport is the same, Shane. Last weekend is history. It's now about what's coming up this weekend. You get no time to rest on your laurels or even enjoy those successes at this time of the year, but all the attention switches, and you know it's a huge weekend for them. Obviously the French are already trying to poke Johnny Sexton, but sure, I guess that comes with the territory for him, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think he mentioned about that scrutiny that has been bestowed upon him via certain French commentators. But Johnny Sexton was actually up in front of the media, and he was chatting to RTÉ's Michael Corcoran a little bit earlier on.
For us, it's just a massive fixture, you know. France away, how many times have we won there over the last, you know, 20, 30 years? Not too many. It takes a special team to go and win there, and it'll take a great performance, and that's all we're focused on. We're not talking about who we're playing. You know, we're obviously giving them the respect that they absolutely deserve, and we're analysing them, and we're looking at their key individuals, etc. But we're playing against, you know, one of the informed teams in the world. You know, we're obviously in good form as well. So yeah, it's been, of course, hyped up. You know, if we can win in Stade de France, it puts you in a good position to win a championship. You know, we've won there a few times over the years, and 2014 we lifted a trophy there. 2018 we started off the Grand Slam year in that game. Like, so if you win there, you've got it gives you a great chance, obviously, of competing for the championship, and we're not hiding away from that. It's a big game.
Yeah, Johnny Sexton there speaking ahead of Ireland's trip to France this weekend. And I suppose, Ruby, all the headlines will be about Le Drop and everything that goes with it. Considering the performance last weekend, and I suppose, would you be even saying France are getting desperate with already trying to single out players and have the mind game started? That must all just play into positivity and that internal kind of good feeling within Irish rugby at the moment.
I think that one of the words you used there is huge in Irish rugby at the minute, and that's positivity. Like, I fully understand the necessity of results in professional sport, and it's about winning however you achieve that. But for someone who loved rugby like I did as a kid and still do, I love the way Ireland are playing now. I love the way they attack. I love that the full 15 players across whichever of the 20 match day 23 or that's even squad of 31 or 2, how they can all intertwine, how they can all play attacking rugby. Now, I know you have to defend and you have to be able to scrummage and line out, but it's when they have the ball in hand, what they're able to do with it. And to me, it's going back to what I always kind of dreamt rugby was. It's not the big smash up. It's not the big hits. It's trying to run around players, trying to find gaps, not run over them. And I think that's beautiful to watch. And I think it's a way forward for rugby when you look at the collisions and I suppose the scrutiny rugby's had with injuries in recent years. I think finding that space and running around guys and trying to win that way, I think it's glorious to watch.
Yeah, that is
working for Andy Farrell.
No, but it is. I completely agree. You know, you want rugby players to be at their peak condition, but also to have those soft kitten hands and just nice little offloads as well. It's not all the days of the baggy jerseys and the rough and tumble of an old Donnybrook and an old Thomond Park and whatnot.
Ah, yeah. Look. I know it's still obviously results are results, but I hope they go to Paris and can play the same way, and it will be a different game. And obviously the two Lions coming back into the Irish setup, you know, Robbie Henshaw and Ian Henderson, and does Andy Farrell make those changes with Bundy Aki, maybe Tadhg Byrne? You know, there's all those deliberations, but they're great problems for a coach to have, to think that you have players like of that standard coming in to push for a place. That's only good for Irish rugby.
Yeah, 100%. It's great to have those positive headaches. But we will be chatting all things rugby with Bernard Jackman on Thursday in detail. So we'll leave our rugby conversation there. And we will welcome into the conversation about association football and all the happenings and all the goings on with the FAI. And I'm delighted to welcome David Snaid, freelance soccer writer, and Gavin Cooney from the 42.ie. Gentlemen, you're very welcome to this Tuesday evening on Game On. I know Marie and Ruby covered a lot yesterday in terms of Euro 2028 bid and what it means, but I just want to play a clip to begin our conversation from FAI Chairman Roy Barrett that he was speaking today, and I want to get your thoughts on this. So if we just have a listen to Roy Barrett.
Like everything, it's not only the bid, there's a whole panoply of different things that we're trying to do at the same time. There's various parts of the game, all who are competing both for time and allocation of money, etc. So we get all of that. This isn't a vanity decision. This isn't a decision which says, listen, we want to host, say, a World Cup or a Euro 2028 finals in Dublin, you know, because it looks good. We believe that if we succeed in this bid, lots of benefits would accrue to the game in Ireland, but also to the country. And given the amount of time and resources that we'd have to commit to it, in the overall scheme of things, one, it's not material, two, it's manageable, and three, it will not get in the way of the really important work which is outlined in the strategy document.
Gavin Cooney, I want to come to you first. Roy Barrett said this isn't a vanity decision. Do you agree?
It's hard to know. I mean, the FAI evidently believe that it's not a vanity decision, and I suppose maybe it was an unfortunate comparison that this was launched yesterday morning and then they launched their strategy document in the evening time, which focused on what they wish to achieve in terms of overhauling overhauling the game in general in Ireland in all sectors, and of course specifically in the realm of stadium development and infrastructure, etc. I think when people listen to things like Roy Barrett has said there, I think one of the frustrations is that when we talk about the benefits of this thing, they're all intangible. Like it's very hard to define. Like, what does a tournament bring? And like, I mean, this was asked on the call yesterday. Like, one of the journalists asked Jonathan Hill to assure that this wouldn't be a drain of resources of the FAI and it wouldn't prove a distraction. And he gave an answer and effectively said it wouldn't. And then all of a sudden, the Scottish FAI chief jumped in to say that, well, we've engaged a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't have been engaged by football. And that's okay, that's fair, and that's understandable. But I think that the Irish fans as well that are critical of this decision or look at say, well, look, your priorities are askew here, they're also conditioned by the past in Ireland, you know, like, I mean, the past of Irish football, where, you know, for the last 15, 20 years, people have put up with, have been given substandard infrastructure and substandard facilities and a whole a whole different cross-section of Irish football, and yet told that everything was okay because everything on the big stage looked okay. You know, they made the international team, were qualifying for major tournaments. We were competing and we won the right to host games of Euro 2020. The former chief executive had a high-ranking role at UEFA. You know, it's just like, everything is good, everything is good. Look up at the sky, everything is good, whereas everything in the grassroots wasn't so good. So I think that when Roy Barrett is fielding questions like that, ask if this is a vanity project, it's informed by the kind of criticism that this decision has been met with.
And David, we will get to the grassroots of football and the rest of the FAI strategic plan in a second, but when you look at Euro 2028, seeing is believing was the slogan of women's sport in 2020. There's no doubt it caught people on. Does the Euros in 2028, if it's in Dublin, could it have the same long-term effect for soccer? Will it draw kids in that are looking at the GAA, looking at rugby, looking at all things, and inspire them to be soccer players?
Well, this is one of the intangibles, I suppose, that Gavin mentioned. Like, personally, if you're looking at kids growing up now, do they need to have a Euros on their doorstep for them to know about what football is and what soccer is? Like, what's important to them is the facilities that they have on a weekly basis and what's there for them. And like, this is the thing, and it's one of the issues, and Gav kind of nailed on the head a little bit. I mean, it's part of the scepticism that's still about even this new FAI and what's actually happening is, when you look at the fact that this was like the bid for this was announced on a morning before they were actually launching their own strategic plan. So then there's natural scepticism that's going to come, saying, well, what's the focus here? What is actually the priority? And it's only natural for that to be there when you've got this major announcement of bidding for a European Championships, and then later on that evening you're talking about what you want the future of the game to be. And if you're looking at these two instances now, you would imagine that they're going to be intertwined, they're going to be interlinked in terms of what happens next. Because if you look at, well, where is Irish football going to be by the time this plan is finished in 2025, if the bid has been successful and people are wondering, well, has it actually been worth it? We only know about what those benefits are in terms of holding an event after it's happened. Because if you look at the fact that one benefit you would like to hope for the FAI would be is that they already have a serious amount of expertise that should be in there, having already been able to successfully bid for, obviously, the Euros in 2020, which obviously were deferred because of COVID, and then Dublin wasn't able to host games because of that. So you would like to think that there's still kind of a strong base there to work from in terms of personnel. Let's believe the cost of it shouldn't be a huge amount in terms of the resources, but it's making sure that the resources that are available, be it more so from personnel wise, isn't going to be drained from so much of the good work that has been happening. And like, you listen there and about Roy Barrett and some of the questions that are being fired at him and that are rightly going to, say, Jonathan Hill, CEO of the FAI, about it being a vanity project. And that goes back to part of the reason why that's being even asked is because it's happened now on the same day about the bid for the Euros and now this strategic plan. So it's like, people are wondering what's actually the priority. And if you go through the actual strategic plan, like, some of it is, you kind of expect a little bit of corporate waffle for want of a better word. You can almost forgive some of that because it's a long document, so some of that needs to pad it out. But when you get into the nitty gritty of what they actually are looking at doing, and even like one of the factors in it was like driving investment to actually achieve the strategy, that's when you do kind of get down into a little bit of the nitty gritty of the numbers and the fact that by the end of 2025 they want to see a 50% increase in sponsorship and partnership revenue. Like, you would like to think that should be attainable considering the men's team at the moment haven't even got a sponsor. You know, like, they're talking about broadcast and content revenue. Interesting, they're talking about content revenue given obviously what could happen there in terms of the social media and all the rest of it. They want that to increase by 50% by the end of 2024. Now, given that one of the other core aspects of the plan is that Ireland in the men's and the women's team can qualify for pretty much every other tournament. If the men's team were then to qualify for, say, Euro 2024, and then the women's team, who are in a fantastic position to possibly get a playoff spot for the World Cup, that should be attainable pretty soon. Like, you want to get into some of the nitty gritty of those numbers, and then some of the more kind of aspirational targets that, they're setting, it's clear that they're still walking towards those, and that's going to become a lot more clear over the next year or so, in particular what they're trying to do with the League of Ireland as well.
So driving investment, a 50% increase, and they're starting at a pretty low base, Gavin, doesn't look unattainable, but what else can they do to drive the industry of soccer? They're talking about having a third tier in the yellow in the League of Ireland by 2023. How are they going to drive enough investment to facilitate the cost of all of that?
I was going to say the million-euro question, really. It's a multi-million-euro question. See, that's the frustration, I think, that the people have had with the strategy document. It states a lot of what the FAI want to achieve, and I don't think anyone, any fair-minded Irish football fan could read what's in it and say that there's anything wrong with what the FAI want to do. It's just how they're going to do it, and that detail in certain areas is lacking. And certainly when it comes to facilities, you know, there is no detail on how much money is available, what funds they can get the money from. The plan in terms of revamping infrastructure at all levels, but particularly League of Ireland level and training grounds and grounds, is to do an audit of them all in 2022 and then form an infrastructure plan next year that you can then bring to government. Now, if you know, there are senior figures at the FAI who are very confident that there will be money forthcoming, and it would be a worthy investment in my own personal opinion and certainly in the FAI's opinion as well. But as to how much money is needed, there's no figure on it yet. I can tell you that it'll be a lot. And as to how realistic their ambitions are to get as well, they just need to develop a plan and put it in front of the government and say, look, this is what we need and this is what it's going to cost. Are you going to back us?
I think it's, you know, right and fair to say, on paper anyway, as we've mentioned there, that the FAI injecting an extra 1.5 million euro into grassroots football is wholly positive, and that's exactly what we want to see. But even on the domestic level of things, David, you and I have probably been to the majority, if not every single League of Ireland ground this country has to offer, and we've seen the facilities and the situation that a lot of grounds are in. And if we are trying to expand the League of Ireland and expand participation levels from young boys and girls from 4 or 5 years of age up, it's all well and good saying a new third tier for the League of Ireland. We've seen a B League before that was pretty dismal, and for a second tier in Women's National League as well. Like, we need to have facilities, and we also need to increase participation rates. So should this not be, instead of looking at Euro 2028 and all of that, to say, hold on a sec, let's actually build from the bottom up here, and let's go around and see what we currently have in the league before we're looking to create new entities? Because even in the underage League of Ireland at the moment, the Mayo League have a team, the Kerry District League are thereabouts, and I know there's rumours of Tralee Dynamos a few years ago joining the League of Ireland set up and the cost that is with it. We've seen Cavan Teely come into the league and all of a sudden they've amalgamated with Bray. So should we not be focusing our attention on what we currently have in place and improving that before we even look at grand designs of increasing?
Well, see, this is it, and this is just, I suppose, a part of the flux, I suppose, a little bit of where Irish football is that, where for a little while clubs, and like, I don't think anyone's mentioned Brexit yet, so I might as well get it out of the way, but it is such a big thing that's going to change the dynamics of Irish football and just basically how it's worked at an underage level. And it's like the fact now that clubs have now realised that our best young players are not going to be able to leave the country before the age of 18. Like, for a while it was kind of not totally unfairly, considering some of the words that were getting back from clubs, he thought that there might be a way around it for Irish players, because obviously the common travel area and all the rest of it. But from a point of view of actually having the facilities in place, and I think I mentioned this to Gav actually earlier, just even before we were on air, but like, even the fact that, say, one of the grassroots coaches that's kind of in the strategic document that's worked out is from Ballyulster, which I thought was quite fitting, purely because Ballyulster is the club who St. Patrick's Athletic rent their training facilities from. Do you know what I mean? So, like, Pat, who finished second in the league last year, won the FAI Cup, would be representing the League of Ireland in Europe, and yet they're renting training facilities from a schoolboy club and a junior club who, you know, in Selbridge. So, like, this is, you have to kind of look for all the good work that is being done from a culture level. Like, you almost felt as if this is a strategic document, you want to put it in place, it's trying to cover a lot, but would they almost be better off saying, well, what's the focus? What can there be a singular focus that they actually look at for a short amount of time? Because, like, to be honest, this as well. It's not as if this is a long, long-term document that's a proper vision for where football is at. It's something that you, like, what are they going to see at the end of 3 years of this, realistically? Like, what will they, that's what we're going to find out as well. Like, what do they actually want to get out of these 3 years, you know? And if you're looking at it from a point of view, and you can kind of get lost down the tunnel of, say, the League of Ireland, and you even hear how even people in the FAI, and they talk about League of Ireland fans, but like, the League of Ireland is now going to be taking on such an important role for the future of Irish football and the development of players, and that's where it's gone, obviously, with the underage system or with the underage leagues. It's, like, that's where the emphasis is being put. But then also, like, not every player who comes through is going to go over then to England, so what's going to be left for them here? But then one of the aspects of it which you're looking at in terms of that document is, and it's beginning to have, Sean McGowan have already done it, and also St. Patrick have done it, or Cork City could be doing it as well. But like, secondary education is going to be vitally important, and that needs to be 100% intrinsically linked with the future of Irish football. We're talking about building an industry. Like, that's not going to be built in the next 3 years. It's going to have some kind of building block in place, and you can't just build it, look at what happens in England and say, well, that's what we need to do. We need to have a kind of a mini system there that's on a smaller scale for that. Like, that's not how Ireland, and especially the way Irish footballers should be operating. It should be 100%, especially when lads can't leave, and for those who are capable of playing abroad as well, can't leave until a certain age. There has to be stuff properly in place for them to give them a reason to stay here, and education just has to be a key factor, and that needs to be properly kind of explored in this document as well.
Kevin, the plan used all the typical words: inspire, inclusion, radical, innovation, diversity, positivity. But both of you have used the one word that was missing, which is realistic. When you look at the population of Ireland and the amount of sports we play, was it a contraction rather than an expansion that the FAI should have looked at to make the money spread further and do things right? Make it tighter rather than wider?
I don't know about that. I think that they needed to have a bold vision in terms of, I think what they need to do is unite the various squabbling forces on the in the game. I mean, the most, you know, the one you'll hear about most obvious is the schoolboys in the League of Ireland. But in terms of contracting the game, I'm not sure how you could politically do that, really. It's a really interesting question. But I think just in terms of, rather than expand, I think the FAI would look at their job rather than expanding or contracting. It is actually uniting, and you can see it in this whole brouhaha over the National Under 14 League. So, without wanting to bore your listeners too much, the context of it is the FAI board decided to kick back the beginning of the National Under 14 League. That's the elite, that's for the elite players in the League of Ireland academies. Kicked that back to the summertime in July this year, so that the best players wouldn't be leaving their schoolboy clubs midway through the season. That caused ructions. Shamrock Rovers condemned it as a random and ill-thought-out decision. That a senior figure of the Schoolboys Football Association of Ireland has since resigned over the decision. And like, the FAI, I think, in fairness, I think the rationale for doing it was fairly sound. They just didn't want under 13 teams to be broken up midway through a season, because, you know, that in order to keep the majority who'd be left behind in the system and keep them happy playing football. But you can argue the communication of it, but it ultimately came down to if League of Ireland and schoolboy factions either didn't trust each other or didn't trust the FAI not to trust each other. So this is what, you know, the marketing slogan behind this is, we are one. And I mean, Jonathan Hill spoke quite kind of statesmanlike, actually, on this thing last night, about talk that everyone owes it to themselves and to the game and to Ireland to, like, leave the enmities of the past behind and unite and work together. And that's absolutely right. He's totally right. As to whether it can happen or not, we wait and see.
So therefore, David, do you think the soccer family in Ireland are willing to maybe break with traditions to unite?
Oh, the soccer family in Ireland. James, I won't like to see them all sitting around the table, that's for sure. there's just, and this is just even from the last little while, and what Gavin's saying there, but it's what it comes out as well, is you want to believe that what the FAI are trying to set in place, that they're going to be able to give give the people who are working in the FAI here and who will actually be the ones who are probably on the ground, give them the resources to go and be able to make a difference. That's what you want to see from this. Because, like, let's be honest, it's still a plan. Like, it is easy to scoff and kind of like maybe before it's even happened, kind of pour scorn on it. And it's, but at the same time, it's only right to still be sceptical and you have to ask questions. Like, this is the plan. They've laid it out now a little bit and you have an idea. And as they said themselves, say with the League of Ireland or other aspects, like, they're going to be doing studies over the next little while that will kind of help maybe inform where to go a bit further. But what you want to see from the FAI, and it's what I got back to when I said back to at the start, is even if this Euro bid is successful, nobody will be complaining about the Euro bid in a few years. Oh, I think it'll be next year if it's successful, because they had to obviously have the expression of interest by March of this year. But no one will be complaining if Ireland and the Euro bid is successful if the plan that they do put in place and the work that is being done over the next 2 years is of top class work and is what's needed. What will be the issue is if people see that stuff that should be happening is being overlooked, or corners are cut, or actual resources that should be placed into areas that have been mentioned, if that's not working right, and which is what had happened before. And the whole point of what's happened now with the FAI and the restructuring of the board, having the independent directors on there and the General Assembly that's now part of the FAI, and also the fact that the government have more of a say as well, considering the money that was there provided as part of the bailout too. So that's what's going to be so important over the next while, and will be an indicator of the fact that the FAI has changed, is the fact that people won't be talking about this bid to host the Euros as a kind of the golden goose that was kind of around the neck of hampering Irish football. That it has to be that it's actually the end. It's at the end when 2028 will be on the next stage of whatever the next strategic plan or what the follow-on is. But hopefully it'll be a follow-on from a successful 3 years. At the moment, and it's only natural because it's a start of it, there are doubts, and it's up to this FAI now and the people who will be running it to allay some of those doubts.
It's funny you mentioned the soccer family, and you were wondering how they'd sit around a table. I think there was meetings upon meetings when there was a power sharing agreement up north about the shape of the table. I suspect there might be something similar if you're trying to fit a lot of people.
That's the good thing now about Zoom. You can just mute the people you don't want to.
This is true. Well, unfortunately, Gavin and David, I'm going to have to mute ye because we have run out of time on our domestic football chat. Just before we do wrap it up, a bit of League of Ireland transfer news today. Sligo Rovers signing a Netherlands-born New Zealand defender that plays in the Portuguese league, Nando Pijnaker, and Dundalk have confirmed the loan signing of Lewis McCary on a 6-month loan from Stoke. He is the grandson of Lou McCary, so a chip off the old block there. But listen, Gavin, David, thank you very much. I'm sure this is a developing story that we'll have you back on again, and there'll be more to talk about with the FAI dealings and hopefully Stephen Kenny's contract in the near future and so on and so forth. So we certainly will be back, and we are going to be back in a few moments continuing the association football narrative. We'll have Mark Langdon on with all things European football.
2FM.
Game on 2FM.
With Green Farm, being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty. Game on European football.
Welcome back to Game On, and we're going to get straight into European football via the UK. I think, Mark Langdon, if we'll go there first, I've often heard the phrase of people going home to kick their cat. I actually never thought it happened, but Kurt Zouma obviously did.
Oh, yeah, I mean, shameful story to wake up to today. Yeah, the video that was released, of course, of Kurt Zouma kicking his cat. I mean, the news has gone down. I think it's about as bad as you could imagine over here. I mean, there are many people calling for him to be sacked. I don't think West Ham will go that far, of course, but clearly going to be difficult, I think, for him to play again in the near future. You know, there's a lot of anger towards Kurt Zouma at the moment. It's not just from opposition fans. I've seen many sort of West Ham fans calling for, you know, severe action from the club. We know that clubs don't tend to write off big money assets and just sort of allow them to leave the club. But I do think it's going to be difficult for him in the near future to sort of play for West Ham again, I think.
Well, we all know what can happen when something like that does happen, and I wouldn't particularly like to be predicting what Kurt Azuma's future will be. But look, as you said, Mark, it was a pretty bad story to wake up to. But anyway, moving away from English football for an hour, for a moment anyway, Mark Overmars has also left his role as Director of Football Affairs at Ajax after the dust cloud said he sent a series of inappropriate messages to several female colleagues.
Yeah, this, again, was a really shock story because Mark Overmars was one of the most in-demand sporting directors around, and there were many people suggesting he was going to leave Ajax and be poached by sort of wealthier clubs. He was linked with Arsenal, he was linked with the Manchester United job, he was linked with the Newcastle United job. He then signed a contract until 2026. So when Ajax announced on Sunday evening that he was leaving with immediate effect, you knew that something had gone on sort of, you know, off the pitch, so to speak. And Ajax have acted swiftly. Edwin van der Sar, sort of president of Ajax, was saying that you just can't behave like that. Overmars is sort of, his legacy, I think, at Ajax will now be tarnished. He was in the middle of rebuilding a very exciting sort of second team. They had that one that reached the semi-finals a couple of years ago of the Champions League, beaten in heartbreaking circumstances, of course, by Spurs. You know, they were one of the most impressive teams in qualifying for the last 16 this time around as well. And he's played a very influential part in the transfers of players, in renegotiating contracts with the ones that they've been able to keep. Obviously, had to go because of those inappropriate messages. He admitted as much himself. It does leave, I think, Ajax in a weaker position to lose someone like Overmars. And I think it will only sort of increase the speculation surrounding their coach, Erik ten Hag, who had worked very closely alongside Overmars.
So, you know, Mark, when I'm reading the quotes that have been coming from Mark Overmars, and I was trying to think how to pose this question, and similar with Kurt Zouma. I mean, Zouma is saying the cats are perfectly fine and healthy. This was an isolated incident. I mean, that doesn't wash with me. And the Mark Overmars statement of, yes, he admitted he was ashamed and it's unacceptable, but and he continued in a statement to the Ajax website last week, I was confronted with reports about my behaviour and how this has come across to others. Unfortunately, I didn't realise that I was crossing the line. And how this has come across to others. I mean, you can't brush off the severity of these two incidents. And I know that they're separate cases and they're separate things that have happened. But for footballers to come out with those excuses and to almost try and brush these off and dissolve them and try and lower the severity of them, like, is this a case of, in general terms, I suppose, far-reaching and wide-reaching, that players need to be more educated and footballers need to be more educated, and you can't throw everyone into the same category? But I mean, to come out with those statements, I don't know your thoughts on it, Mark, but I mean, that's surely not good enough.
No, I mean, both statements were, I think, lacking in empathy, really. And, I think a cynic would say they were sorry they got caught rather than sorry for the incidents themselves. I think it's always dangerous to lump sort of, you know, footballers with the same tag. There's been some rough stories in the last few weeks regarding footballers, but I try not to sort of, you know, just categorise it as, footballers need to do better or, rugby players need to do better or anything like that. I mean, I think these, you know, they're grown adults. They're capable of making and choosing right from wrong, if they so wish. And I don't necessarily think it's a football problem, just as much as it's probably something in society that needs to be sorted out rather than just in football. It will always, of course, because it's football, it will always be labelled that, this is a money thing and that people are doing this because they can. I don't know. That doesn't sort of ring true with me because, I mean, there are many kind of rich and wealthy footballers that don't behave in this manner and, you know, who also give a lot to charity and, you know, their time to worthwhile causes. So I prefer not to lump it together as a football problem. But I think that in this instance, both statements were weak. I think Ajax were very decisive in the way that they got rid of Overmars. They didn't sort of, you know, suspend him and wait for some, you know, as is quite often the case, you know, wait 6 months and see what happens. You know, they were very, very quick to cut ties with somebody, like I say, that was very important to the club. The West Ham one, it was a strong statement, I thought, from West Ham, but, you know, you have to wait to see sort of if they back up those actions. I think we've seen many times before that, you know, because they're such valuable assets that they're not maybe treated like somebody else would be in a normal job. And it's been pointed out that you know, there was a teacher who kicked a horse in the UK that lost her job and, you know, received a suspended prison sentence as well. And, you know, it's one rule for one and one rule for the other. It's a difficult one. I mean, I think that the Kurt Zouma incident has worked up a lot of people. And I think even if he does play again for West Ham, the reaction he's going to get at every single stadium, maybe even including his own, you know, he's going to be suffering for a long time, at least in that respect.
I know Ruby Walsh has a question, but I did want to just come in very briefly and say, like, I'm not categorising all footballers in that regard, but I am a genuinely big football fan. And it is a case of just these two individuals and their despicable acts, I think, is something I think that is the point here in terms of not trying to tar them in. Ruby.
Good recovery, Shane. Good recovery. You got yourself out of that one well. Mark, European football have also released a landscape, I suppose, of how UEFA is going and European football. And their president, Alexander Seferin, was out talking about it today. I found some of the figures fascinating, that they're predicting a €4 billion loss for European top flight clubs in 2021, which exceeds the €3 billion they lost in 2020. I cannot get my head around the financial model of soccer. How exactly does it work that you can lose that amount of money and still be going?
No, it wouldn't work in very few other businesses. Obviously, this has been a particularly sort of tough time, and I think that actually there have been people that have come into soccer from maybe other sort of countries. I'm thinking particularly the US, that have actually found the business model just absolutely chaotic and crazy and can't get their head around it. And this is coming from, you know, in the US, of course, they don't really have, like in a lot of instances, they don't have transfer fees. You know, all that money goes to, you know, goes to the players. But within that transfer fee sort of ecosystem, you would imagine that clubs should be able to look after themselves. But of course, they nearly all spend more than they can really afford. It felt like for a while that maybe COVID would keep everybody in check. But I think all that has meant is that some teams have got desperate and are trying to sort of push and take advantage in some respects of a weaker market, which has meant that they are spending too much. If you go back to the European Super League argument, I mean, that was shot down by just about everybody. And, you know, I don't think that it would have been a particularly appealing sort of league for myself either. But I think it was argued at the time that the only way that sort of these big European clubs could sort of get themselves into a position where they were making money would be if they were able to go to a European Super League. And there is an argument that maybe, you know, the Champions League money, while it seems like a lot, there's still a considerable amount that goes out of the game to UEFA. So I think that the bigger clubs have argued that they should receive even more of that money. My argument would be that, you know, if you can't afford Erling Haaland or you can't afford Kylian Mbappe, then you should just not buy them and, you know, live within your means. But I think that disappeared a long time ago, and there's just so many teams chasing the dream. And then there are some, of course, that are funded by states. You know, we've got Newcastle now with Saudi Arabia sort of, you know, being owned by them. And, you know, it's only going to, I think, increase the power of some of those teams. There's some English teams that are, I think, now just able to really flex their financial muscles, and you'll see that in the Champions League over the next few years, because they're looking quite dominant to me at the moment.
I thought it was interesting too that the Premier League or English clubs account for 27% of the global transfer activity, 34% of global transfer spending, and 20% of global transfer income.
Yeah, I mean, and that sort of plays into what I was just saying there, really, about the advantage that the English teams have got. There are some teams in sort of European leagues that are happy in some respects that the English teams have got that money, because it does mean that they're able to sell players for a lot of money. If you think of Lyon, who've just sold Guimaraes to Newcastle for in excess of 40 million. I don't think there was anybody else really. He said he turned down Arsenal, but I don't think Arsenal were going to go to the length maybe that Newcastle did to sign him. A young Brazilian midfielder that's full of potential, but it is only potential. And yet Newcastle were able to outspend just about anybody else in Europe to sign him. And there's a team that's sort of struggling at the wrong end of the Premier League. You look at there was a German team, Bayer Leverkusen, said they were competing with a newly promoted English club back in the summer for a player. Leverkusen knocking on the door of the Champions League, in the Europa League at the moment. And they couldn't keep up with what the English promoted team were offering the player. They didn't name which one. They were linked with Rashica, who eventually went to Norwich. But, I mean, that just goes to show the financial power of English football. I think the rest are really struggling to keep up. Maybe they are living, some of them, within their means, but some of the kind of Real Madrids and Barcelonas, I feel like they feel under pressure to go out and try to spend the same amounts, but they're not getting the same TV income from their La Liga deal as what the Premier League are getting.
I think this just further emphasises that sport is indeed a business now these days, or football indeed is a business as opposed to a sport. And listen, we've had, I suppose, the bewildering figures of European football there and two negative stories. But Mark, I want to mention the French Cup. And it's not very often the French Cup gets a mention on Game On, but the French Cup quarterfinals are tomorrow, and the magic of the Cup, there's two fourth division teams that have been drawn against each other, Bergerac against Versailles, and it's being played in a stadium that is officially not up to the standard required for a quarterfinal. But that's not all there is to the tale.
No, it's not. I mean, yeah, we've just spoken there of, you know, so many depressing stories in football. This is a nice one to see two teams from the fourth tier in the quarterfinal, like you say, of the French Cup. So the game's having to be played, Bergerac anomaly at home, but it's still being played 50 kilometres away from their ground, because they had to move, not this time, they've had to move this season to somewhere more suitable because their ground isn't really up to it anymore. But the Versailles were, I think, understanding of Bergerac's problems, because Versailles are in the unusual position of not being able to play matches with floodlights on. There is a very ancient law in France where in terms of the Versailles, of a night time, you can't have lights on within the eyes of the king's palace. So that means a 5 kilometre distance between the palace and the surrounding area. In Versailles, the stadium is within 5 kilometres of the king's palace, so they're unable to have floodlights. They have to play all of their matches in the daytime, so they've got this quarterfinal. So it's probably just as well that they were drawn away from home, because otherwise the game would have had to have taken place probably around about lunchtime.
And there I was thinking France was a republic. And I tell you, there's some League of Ireland grounds that apartment prices go up in price because they have a good view of the stadium. Inchicore springs to mind, and the Richmond Road and Tulka Park springs to mind as well. So I can't see the issue here. I cannot see the issue. Mark Langdon, unfortunately, that is all we've time for our European football chat. But I do want to just mention some breaking news domestically. Listeners out west in Galway will be delighted to hear that Galway have announced the signing of Irish underage international Jenna Slattery. The 17-year-old Limerick native Slattery signs from Treaty United, where last year she scored 10 goals in Women's National League and was also Treaty United's Senior Player of the Year. So potential signing of the season for Galway there. Mark Langdon, thank you very much. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have Gary Murphy chatting all things golf, and indeed Leona Maguire's meteoric rise over the weekend.
Game On 2FM.
With Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game On. Go.
Now you're very welcome back to Game On as we turn our attention to golf, and we welcome professional golfer Gary Murphy to the show on this Tuesday evening. Gary, how are you? Did you enjoy the weekend? And I suppose there is only indeed one place to start. Leona Maguire, her maiden LPGA Tour win. Just how big is this for Irish golf? Because we've seen all the headlines about this will do wonders for the game. But in terms of tangible kind of progression, what will it do?
Hi, Shane. It'll do a lot for Leona because I think the difficulty with any time you have a huge season, it's trying to back it up the following year, no matter, you know, what sport you're in. You look at Leicester winning the league, they haven't sniffed it since, so I'm not equating Leona to Leicester, but, you know, she had a massive year last year, almost won Rookie of the Year, went to the Solheim, she was unbeaten, she was the superstar of the show. You know, and you're just trying to, you know, keep that going as such. So for her to win her second start of the season is enormous. The style that she won it in, obviously Lexi Thompson is, you know, she's not the best player in the world, but she's one of the superstars of the sport. And she was chasing her down, but Leona was just too good for everyone. So it's a huge, you know, start of the season. And obviously she, as she's alluded to, she did a lot of work in the off season with her game, trying to just keep improving. So it's onwards and upwards for, you know, whether it filters down or not, I'm not sure. I know we've a lot of good young women coming through the rankings, but it's just great for her. But she's a superstar. No, she's been a superstar since she's been about 10, so it's no surprise that this is happening.
She shot 66, Gary, 60, 66, 65, 67, and you're saying, like, we've a lot of good girls coming along, but she's the first lady to play on the LGPA, Irish lady to play on the LGPGA, LPGA, if I get it right eventually, and she can only inspire more. But you said she worked through the close season to improve in her game, and as you watched her on Sunday, what improvements did you see?
Well, her big thing, Ruby, is her accuracy is ferociously good. You know, obviously distance is something that I don't think she should get too hung up on. You know, she hits the ball plenty far. We've seen a lot of great players in the past go down that road. It's just motivation every week. You know, stats-wise, you know, her putting is exceptionally good. Just little bits, maybe her bunker play could improve. That's something she would look at. As with all these top players, it's their scoring clubs is what they're working on the whole time. So she's alluded to the fact she's trying to get a little tighter proximity to the hole with her wedge play. You know, and that's just something you do week in, week out. It's not, you know, it's not something out of the ordinary. It's just the fact that she's not a power player, so she has to be as accurate as possible. But she just seems so calm under fire. You know, the last round, she held the putts. She did everything right. She kind of held the putts when she had to, and kept everyone at bay. And it's just a huge start to her season because it gives her that exemption for a couple of years. She can get into all the bigger events. She can pick and choose. She doesn't have to, you know, because the big challenge for rookies coming out is you probably have to play a lot more than you want to, because you play when you get in, whereas now she can pick and choose. I know she's going to the Far East in the next couple of weeks, but she would have done that anyway. But, you know, it's just great kickstart to her season. She's up into, I think, 20th now in the world rankings, which, you know, from what are really realistically her third full year as a pro, it's a huge leap, because the talent pool at the top end of the women's game is huge. You know, you've got superstars in front of her, so it's not easy win out there. So for her to be in that category so quickly is fantastic.
And learning to win can be a huge thing. She led all the way down the back stretch on a Sunday or Saturday afternoon, as it was.
Yeah.
But learning to win can only give her confidence, can it?
Yeah, you know, and sleeping on the lead, you know, waking up nervous, trying to get your brekkie down, you know, all those things that, you know, people probably take for granted when they're just looking at it, you know, at a golfer out on a golf course. There's the human element of dealing, you know, at times, you know, all the stuff before you even get to play is the hard part of trying to control your nerve. And I think, you know, her greatest attribute is she's got a really strong mind. She's very disciplined and focused in what she's doing, And then, you know, it can't be understated the difference Dermot Byrne has made to her game since he came on the bag last May. You know, Dermot's been on tour now for probably 30 years, almost. He probably wouldn't want me to say that, but, you know, he's a wealth of experience, and he's experienced in this too because, you know, he gave up a really solid bag with Peter Lowry and took a leap of faith in Shane Lowry when Shane first came on tour and, you know, was a catalyst for Shane to go on to have, you know, the amazing career that he is having. So, you know, Dermot will be a great help to Leona, dealing with, you know, the little bit of fame as well, and keeping her head down and continuing to work hard and realise that, you know, it's a journey week in, week out. You know, there's the good weeks and bad weeks, and to appraise everything in a, you know, in the manner that he would be used to from being around the block for so long.
It's great to have those experienced voices around you. And you, like you mentioned earlier, Leona's been a star since she was 10. But how much do you think the process that she took in terms of being extremely patient with her development and having the right people around, the route she took and the avenue she took to get here eventually? I mean, she was what, ranked 177th at the start of last year, and now she's up 17 places to a career high of 20. So how much is that down to the patience and just biding her time and not trying to get too carried away, and indeed having the right voices around? How much has that contributed to where she is now?
Well, I think the big point is that you have the belief system to hang on and wait to turn pro when you feel that you're, you know, it's the right time to do it. I was delighted at the time because we had her on the show. We were up in Slieve Russell when she got beaten in the playoff as an amateur in an LET event. You know, it would have been easy to kind of jump on the bandwagon there and, you know, go off and turn pro and do all of that. And many amateurs have done that. And it's a big leap. And she wanted to go through the college system in America. She did 4 years in Duke University, which is a great, great golf school, but it's also a great academic school. She got a first-class honours degree. You know, and then made that transition onto the Symetra Tour, which is not easy to get off that, to get onto the LPGA Tour. You know, we saw that with Olivia Mahaffey last year, who's an outstanding amateur, and she's trying to find her feet in the pro ranks. You know, but Leona kind of, it seems like it's a bit of a jigsaw for her, that she just seems to take things off and does it at her own pace. Because at 27, you know, relative to the way the game is going at the moment, you know, they seem to be younger and younger coming out on tour and breaking through. So she's a very, you know, wise head and an old head on still quite young shoulders. But at 27, you know, you'd normally be looking at 21, 22 for this sort of stuff. So I think she's in a really good space in her career. And it's exciting, you know, because we've never had any superstar on the women's side of the game for kids to look up to. It's always been about the men. So it's great for Leona. And I have to mention Stephanie Meadow as well, because, you know, Leona would have learned a lot from Stephanie too, because Stephanie had an amazing amateur career and went out and, you know, almost won a US Open, her first or third start, I think so. You know, they'll be good pals on tour, and they can learn from one another. And just out there, keeping your card on tour is a huge thing. So it's great to have two Irish women out there doing it.
Absolutely, it is. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for. Gary, thank you very much. It's great to see Leona's rise, and we wish her all the best in the years to come. And indeed, Seamus Power and Shay Lowry and all of the other Irish representatives. My thanks to all our guests and contributors this evening, Mark Langdon, David Snide, and Gavin Cooney. And indeed to you, Ruby Walsh. It's been a pleasure to keep you company on Tuesday evening. Tara Kumar is up next. We'll be back in Game On same time tomorrow.
With Green Farm, rise and grind and the hustle mindset aren't real. The protein in our chicken and turkey is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.